Well, good evening. My name is Rick Hansen. I serve as the chair of the Environment, Finance, and Natural Resources Division Committee. I think that's the proper name. And I'm going to welcome you all here to this public hearing. We're actually having it as part of a public hearing, so it is being recorded. We want to make sure, as part of the mini session, that we are involving members of the community and hearing from you, as well as hearing from some experts on some topics that we talked about a bit in the legislative session. We did some action, and we're hearing some more from. So there were bills introduced and some action taken, and we want kind of a follow-up, because as legislators, we haven't really, until the last couple of days, haven't been together as a group since the legislature adjourned on May 25th. So this is helpful for us. We go back into regular session on February 11th, 2020. So hearing from you and hearing from folks in the community is very important. I do want to just take a moment for people to introduce themselves and a little bit on process. We are going to be hearing kind of in three topic areas today. One from the Outdoor Heritage Council Executive Director, because we're in a joint hearing with the Legacy Committee, and Chair Lilly here is chair of that. That'll take about 5 minutes, and we'll have questions from members and from the audience for 5 minutes or so, or 10 minutes after that. Then we will go into microplastics and water, and we'll have two speakers there, and then we'll have questions from members and questions from the public on that topic. And then we will go into pollinators. We have three speakers there, and we'll have questions from the public and questions from members. And then we'll have an open dialogue just on any topics, and I think we adjourn at 6, if I'm understanding correctly. So when the testifiers come forward, ones giving the formal presentations, if they could maybe use the microphone there so that they're heard. If you are a member of the audience and like to ask a question, just use the microphone there. I can see the green light is on. Are you able to hear me clearly? Okay. Well, why don't we introduce ourselves? Nathan?
I'm Nathan Nelson.
So yeah, Nathan Nelson, I represent Pine and Kanawha counties, and I'm elected in a special election, so I'm a little bit new here compared to some of the others, but it's great to be here. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Fu Lee. I serve in the House District 59A. That's in North Minneapolis.
Hi, I'm Representative Leon Lilly. And I represent three East Metro communities, North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale. And as Chair Hansen mentioned, I'm chair of the Legacy Committee, and that's the committee that covers much of what the Clean Water Council does, and Lassard Sams, who we're going to hear from in a few minutes, and then the arts and cultural heritage part of the money as well, and then the parks and trails. But we're not going to really focus on much of that today, but but the Clean Water Council will be covered, of course, or Clean Water and the Lassard Sams. But thank you.
Thank you. And as I mentioned, my name is Rick Hansen. I represent Northern Dakota County, South St. Paul, West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Mendota, and Lilydale. And Representative Lilly and I were both elected we're more vintage members. We were elected in 2004, so just yesterday.
Hello, I'm Ann Claflin. I represent South St. Paul, Cottage Grove, Great Cloud Island, Newport, and St. Paul Park. That's just in the Southeast Metro. And I'm also the Vice Chair on the Environmental Finance Committee.
Good evening. My name is Peter Fish. I represent the Northeast communities around St. Paul of Maplewood, White Bear Lake, Birchwood, Willerney, and Monomedi.
And so, and I'm also, not only do I serve on the Environment Committee, but I'm chair of the
I also want to acknowledge Peter Strohmeyer, who has helped put all this together, and Mike Molzon and Zach. Thank you for the work you've done. So we'll start right out. Mark, you want to tell us a little bit about the Outdoor Heritage Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the Executive Director for the Start Sam Outdoor Heritage Council. Thank you for having this meeting. It's really interesting to see how that's going to fall. The Outdoor Heritage Council, as a staff, is to start Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council.
There we go. Want me to start over, Mr. Chair?
If you could, maybe just introduce
for the record. For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the Executive Director for the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. The Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, for the audience, is a legislative nonpartisan council of 8 citizens and 4 legislators, 2 senators, 2 representatives, 1 from each party. So again, very, very nonpartisan entity. And it is tasked with the job of making recommendations for appropriation by the legislature for funds from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. The Outdoor Heritage Fund is about a third of the monies that come in through the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy sales tax that the citizens passed in 2008 and became effective in 2009. Since 2009, we have annual funding, annual requests that we put out for proposals. And each year, it ends up being an average of somewhere of around $100 million of tax dollars that come in just to the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And then the council looks at all the different projects that come in. This year, we had about 44 projects, 45, I think. And of those, it was over $300 million worth of requests for funding. So there's always more than enough. But the job of the council is to look at those and say, which are the best? And what will really do the right thing with the dollars, and vet them, and then from that make recommendations on how much should be funded to whom. And those recommendations then go into a bill form and come to the legislature for debate and review. There are 2 different areas of grants within which the citizens are always interested in. There's the larger grants directly from the or which the council reviews, which are the those that are $400,000 or more. And then there are the smaller grants, which are really made to get local communities and local small nonprofit groups and citizen and public interest groups involved. Those are the grants that are under $400,000 each. And that is, we call those the Conservation Partner Legacy Grants. And the DNR actually distributes those. Also, before they distribute them, naturally, they vet those projects very well with technical review committees. And but it's a much easier process for the small grants, and it's a nice way to get it into the small communities and really spread the money around more. The dollars for the Outdoor Heritage Funds are used for habitat. They are to restore, protect, and enhance habitat for game, fish, and wildlife. That's a statutory and a constitutional dedication of those funds. So the legislature, the council, as well as the legislature, take it very seriously whenever the funds are up for recommendation for appropriation, and rightly so. Some of the local projects which some of the citizens in this area of the state may be interested in is we have a lot of trout stream work goes on down here because it's the premier area of the state for trout. There's also, though, a lot of prairie work that goes on down here, and not just normal native prairie, but also goat prairies and bluffland work. As well as the state forests and enhancing those forests or those prairies or those goat prairies or whatever it might be. It's such a unique area of the state that all of the areas, all of the work kind of overlaps here. And there have been some lands that have been acquired and put into state ownership for state forest or for WMAs down in this neck of the woods. There's also work that's been done along the Mississippi. And there will be more. Lake Pepin was one that was, there's some work going on up there that was funded in the last legislative session. There's an awful lot that happens. I would be remiss if I did not mention that the citizen component of the council right now is short one. We lost our chairman, Bob Anderson from International Falls, passed away a couple weeks ago, unfortunately. And he will be missed greatly. He was a Senate appointee, and the Senate now has the job of appointing another citizen in that place. So for the people that are listening, for the audience, that position has, that opening has just been posted on the Secretary of State website. So if anybody is interested in finding out about becoming a member of the council or applying to become a member of the council for that Senate appointment, they definitely could go on the Secretary of State website. They could talk to me tonight, or they contact their local senator, I think Senator Miller, locally. So that those are all opportunities. With that, Mr. Chair, there's so much that goes on. I think I should probably just open it to you for questions, if you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We're kind of tag teaming this, so is there any questions from any members or anything? Or, okay, seeing none. I'd like to hear if there's anybody in the crowd that'd like to has any questions of, as regards to Lasard Sams, or yeah, please come to the microphone and if you're willing, yeah, take your time.
It's turned on.
Yep.
Okay.
Looks like a green light. Go ahead. Please state your name for the record. And,
Carol Jefferson. I'm a professor emeritus here at Winona State, a plant ecologist. By the way, I was on the Fisher's Advisory Committee for Section Wildlife for 10 years. That was a long drive up to St. Paul once a month. But my question for you, sir, is in regard to getting able to get these grants for some of the state universities. We have gotten some money for the, we share a fairly large part. It mostly belongs to Winona State, but some to the city. And we can, we're doing savanna restoration on the city property, but we really need to work on the much larger portion, which is the state university. And I have set up a small endowment, but my endowment will be totally work on the natural, repairing our natural habitats there. The Garvin Heights Cougar Woods, that's a natural area that doubles the size of Garvin Heights Park. But that would be burned up in one summer. So I wonder why the state universities are excluded from getting the money. Why do we have to go to the smallest part of the Garvin Heights Cougar Woods, which is a city portion, only a few acres compared to what the state university has? There's no funding here for that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And ma'am, actually, we should talk. This is a great segue because I'm always looking for people who are interested in applying for funds so we can bring new folks in. The universities are not restricted from applying. The restriction really comes in that it has to be for habitat work. So it's on the ground, it's not for research work. And often that's why oftentimes the university will go to the Environmental Trust Fund and LCCMR. But there are opportunities, especially if it's on public lands, which would be university land, or permanently protected land, which would be.
Well, I think a problem here is I was instrumental in doubling the size of Garvin Heights Kruger Woods, and that land was donated to the University Foundation. I think part of the problem is there. Our really major problem is we have this beautiful large piece of woods, and Oriental bittersweet has completely run over the prairie. It's run over the savanna. We have invasive Norway maple. We're losing the ash. We've lost the elms. We're probably about to lose the walnuts. We have these seepage areas, a very cold water seepage areas, but we can't figure out how to get money to get to that natural area that the university foundation has. Is that excluded? Every time we've looked at it, we've concluded it is. I'll talk to you later then.
Mr. Thank Johnson you. Probably has a quick answer, but I think there's some other funds that we can probably help you with and navigate, parks and trails money and other funds too. But Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I will get my card to this lady. And
thank you. We have 3.5 miles of hiking trails up there, by the way.
We'll look forward to it.
Thank you for the question. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Please state your name and go ahead.
My name is Mike Kennedy. I'm a citizen here in Winona, Minnesota. Mr. Johnson, I have a question. Have you been able to keep your legacy funding without having the legislator try to abscond with some of it?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, sir, Yes, the legislature has been very good about respecting and listening intently to the council and their recommendations. Part of that, I think, is because, and the large part of that is because of the transparency, where we do have legislators as well as citizens on the council. There's always somebody, a legislator or non-legislator, who has a difference of opinion. But legislature has been very good in working through those things.
I think it was, there's so many environmental politics to watch these days that I don't remember the final end of it. Was it to do with the buffers or some matching money? I take it didn't happen. You have retained the legacy funds in the way that they were intended to be retained?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, sir, you may be thinking of the Environmental Trust Fund, which is a little different and has some different allowable uses for those dollars, which are debated also within the legislature. But as far as outdoor heritage funds go, we've been very fortunate. It's a good setup. The structure of the council in law is very, very well structured, so that the legislature has a great opportunity to work with it.
Okay, thanks for the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. So just so that generally folks know, the legacy funds were the sales tax, we went to the voters and the voters approved that, like Mr. Johnson mentioned earlier, in 2008. And part of the sales tax, 3/8 of 1%, goes to those areas. And then Representative Hansen's on the LCCMR, which spent some of the lottery money. So if you happen to buy a lottery ticket tonight, and part of that, if you don't win the $1 million, or part of that goes to that fund, and they do projects all over the state as well. So any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Again, I'm sorry about your loss of your chair and Representative Eklund for your mayor. I served with him. He was a very class act and did a very good job, and you do as well. You mentioned earlier about some of the work that's done here, and our committee just had an opportunity to get onto we got a great picture of him holding some trout that are within, 3 miles of here? And that's a shoreline restoration done by your efforts and the Trout Unlimited. Pretty neat project, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And just Chair Lilly had mentioned the LCCMR. The LCCMR is currently going through a strategic planning process, and there's a survey that you can participate in until the end of October to provide input on the direction. The dedication of the lottery dollars was done by constitutional amendment, and that dedication ends in 5 years, in 2024. So we're looking at the last 5 years on whether or not that goes back to the ballot. We want to make sure that people are aware of that process. So if you are interested in that, just a note, the presentations, we do have a couple of PowerPoint presentations, I believe. We will be putting those on the committee website. So for our committee, if you look on the House of Representatives website and you look at the Environment Finance Division, you can look at all of the bills that we consider and pass. You can also find the presentations that we see, the PowerPoints, and also the data. We will put scientific reports up on that as well. So that will be posted after this meeting, probably not tonight, but in a few days. So with that, we will move to the next topic, which is plastics on the environment. And we were going to be hearing from Courtney Baker with the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. She had an emergency. She's just published a paper about microplastics in the Mississippi River. But our second speaker is going to be our first, and we're pleased to welcome Jim Kelly from the Minnesota Department of Health to talk about what's happening with plastics, microplastics, and water. Welcome, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Kelly. I'm with the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here to talk about an effort that we're undertaking with support from the legislature that has to do with the issue of microplastics in water in our environment. Just as my colleague, Mr. Johnson, talked about the Outdoor Heritage Fund, this work is funded by another portion of the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, the Clean Water Fund. And money through that fund is appropriated or managed in part by the Clean Water Council, which is made up of citizens and legislators who will help come up with a formulations and plans for this work to look at various aspects of clean water. This past session, $400,000 was appropriated through the Clean Water Fund to the Department of Health to work cooperatively with our fellow agencies, the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Agriculture, to sample surface water and groundwater, including drinking water sources, and for an assessment to evaluate the potential risks from micro and nanoplastics and identify appropriate follow-up actions. So that's rather a large task that we're undertaking. To look at this, you know, a very, very much of an emerging issue. And this funding came to our program at the Minnesota Department of Health, which is known as the Contaminants of Emerging Concern Program, which was created to basically look ahead to see at issues that are coming down the pike that could impact our water, our drinking water, and hopefully come up with guidance and even more importantly, actions and steps that can be taken to minimize the impact of these emerging contaminants before they become a problem. I think the issue of microplastics fits very well with that, and we're anxious to get started on this effort with our fellow agencies. In terms of the roles of the different agencies, we serve different purposes. We all work in the water arena. The Pollution Control Agency, for instance, monitors and assesses the environmental occurrence of contaminants. They evaluate sources and look at risk to aquatic life. Our department is responsible for protecting sources of drinking water and assessing risk to human health that could result from contamination in drinking water sources. We work with the Department of Agriculture around the area of pesticides and agricultural products to ensure that they're not affecting human health or the environment. And we coordinate with the Department of Natural Resources in areas around monitoring aquatic life, such as fish, which has been one of the concerns associated with the issue of microplastics. So all four of our agencies together, along with some other additional agencies, Bowser, Met Council, others that we want to bring to the table as well, will be forming an interagency work team to start to address this issue using the funding that was appropriated to the department. We kind of kicked off this effort on Tuesday with a meeting that we held at the Wilder Center in St. Paul that was focused on the issue of microplastics in water. We brought in speakers and heard from speakers from both our department, from Dr. Elizabeth Miner from the University of Minnesota Duluth, who's been working on this issue of microplastics in the Great Lakes as well as in the lake systems within the state of Minnesota. We heard from a hydrologist with the United States Geological Service who's done a lot of work both in Minnesota and elsewhere to try to characterize the occurrence of these materials. We heard from the University of Minnesota who's done some studies on the occurrence of microplastics in food products, and including, I'm afraid, beer, where we do find on occasion these types of materials showing up in packaging materials that then are into food products. So that was kind of the morning talks were focused on what do we know about this? How do we measure it? Where is it at? And what kind of is this issue? Our afternoon sessions, and we heard from the Recycling Association of Minnesota, as well as from the owner of a zero waste market that's opened in Minneapolis, that were really geared at what kind of actions could be taken or can be looked at to try to reduce what are some of the likely sources to this. It's going to take us a while to understand both where these materials are being found and then their potential impacts to aquatic life as well as to human health. So we don't want to wait while the science in general starts to come up with more answers in those areas. One of the main problems is there's no standard way to monitor for these microplastics in water. Everyone's doing things a little bit differently, so it makes it very difficult to compare studies from one to the other. So developing standardized methods is something that we're going to be looking at and trying to focus on. But we know while we develop those things, we don't want to wait for all the answers before we start to look at what actions can be taken. And I think the next speaker is going to talk about just one area where we can already identify an opportunity to take action to try to reduce the input of microplastics to Minnesota's environment, which will help keep them out of our aquatic organisms and keep them out of our drinking water sources. So we look forward to working with our fellow agencies to explore these issues, and we'll be coming back to you regularly with reports on what kind of activities are going on, as well as updating the Clean Water Council. We expect this work will take the next couple of years as we work with the appropriation and work with our various partners and other entities around the state. We're really open to ideas and opportunities. We gathered a lot of input at our session, and I'm anxious to hear what input citizens might have here at this meeting that might help inform some of this work as well. So with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions, and I'll be here to answer them.
Any questions, members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so Ms. Baker, unfortunately, is not here, but can you tell us what are you doing right now with regards to the Mississippi River, knowing that that is a source of drinking water for many many people here in the state of Minnesota, especially, you know, for me being from the city of Minneapolis, that's where we get our drinking source.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leah, that is definitely one of the concerns, is that these microplastics have been found in our sources of drinking water. Some of the efforts that we saw, or some of the studies that we saw at the meeting we held on Tuesday, suggest that most wastewater treatment will be effectively remove at least a portion of these fibers, so that while they're present in the source water, the types of treatments that most of our water systems are using to treat that source water are pretty effective at removing these types of materials. We need to do more study on that. We need to better understand how these things can be most effectively treated to both keep them out of the environment and then keep them out of our drinking water.
Maybe if, are we seeing similar research being done in surrounding states or the Canadian provinces? What are you doing in terms of literature review on microplastics?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question. There are other states and other organizations who are looking into this issue. There's been major reports just in the last several months from an environmental group as well as the World Health Organization that have really tried to look into this from a broader perspective, and we're definitely looking and referring to that literature. We'll be in contact with representatives from other states and other organizations who are engaged in this work. We have been following the literature. It's a very evolving, rapidly changing area of literature. Just last week, there was a study that was released that looked at tea bags, commercial tea bags, and that apparently will yield, not unsurprisingly perhaps, when you cover them with boiling water, that if they're made of a plastic type material, they will yield microfibers into the tea. So, and that just came out last week. So there's a lot of places that we're looking at and a lot of information that we're trying to wrap our kind of heads around, but we expect to continue that work in full force.
Any questions from the public? Yep. If you could go to the microphone, please.
My name's Mike Jensen, glad to meet you. There's a couple of things that I have a little concern about. One is, what about private wells and treating that water? Do we need to? I don't know. The other one is disposable takeouts. We try to bring our own, but everybody says when you say, don't you have paper? Too expensive. What can we do about it?
Mr. Chair, thank you for your questions. Private wells and the issue of whether these materials can get into the groundwater is definitely within our purview with this project. So we will be looking at whether there's a potential for these fibers to reach groundwater. I don't have an answer for that right now, but that will definitely be part of the agenda. In terms of materials, I think one of the things we heard from our public sort of input at the meeting we had on Tuesday is that consumers are certainly one of the major touch points with this issue and influencing consumer habits, consumer demands around what types of materials they're able to purchase or they're using for takeout, for instance, are definitely going to have to be part of the solution. Source control, reducing the amount that's going into our waste stream, which is tied in part to what gets into the environment, is definitely has to be part of the picture.
Any other questions on plastics or microplastics? Yep.
Mike Kennedy again. how much, $400,000 over, you talked about 3 years of programming. It's not going to go very far. I'm wondering how much of that is spent on education. One of the, with micro or if they're even into nanoparticles, I know that when we had many hearings down here in southeastern Minnesota on frac sand, we talked about nanoparticles and their effect on humans. So I would think up front, money would be well spent on education to the public. The public's hearing more and more about these issues, tea bags, the advent of everything coming in plastic bottles is quite an issue, not only for the plastic particles, but for the recycling and the ocean full of plastics that they're trying to mine now. So I would think that a good place to spend money would be on education of the consumer.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your question, Mr. Kennedy. I agree fully. I think this is a particular issue where using the funding solely for research and sampling, I think we know what we're likely to find, which that there are microfibers, microplastics in our environment. The question is as much, what are we going to do about that? And what can we do about that to help prevent that in the future? And that, as I said just a minute ago, consumer education, influencing consumer habits is definitely going to have to be part of that solution. So I would fully anticipate that we'll use some of this funding to help conduct public education, whatever form that's going to take. But definitely that needs to be part of the process.
And just to answer a little bit on both questions, and it somewhat relates back to your previous question. So there were $250 million plus dollars recommended by the Clean Water Council for a two-year appropriation. I authored that bill, and I amended that bill to spend several million of those dollars, which were different than the Clean Water Council's recommendations. And the goal was to use those dollars to, in every monitoring effort that is made in the state, whether it's groundwater, private wells, or drinking water, surface water, existing water monitoring networks, that each agency, so we provided appropriations to each agency to look for microplastics right now. And the Senate had zero. I introduced that bill and I put out my version of the bill. We debated it in my committee and in Representative Lilly's committee. It goes to Representative Lilly. It was passed off the House floor with several million dollars over the next 2 years out of the 258 million. So we changed about 10%. The legislature changed about 10% of the Clean Water Council's recommendations. And it was primarily looking at microplastics and cover crops in wellhead protection areas and doing other forever green. We added more money for forever green. So several areas where we tweaked those council recommendations. We have letters from the Clean Water Council and the agencies opposing that changing of the effort. The Senate had no changes. And Representative Lilly, the only reason there's 400,000 plus in there is because he was able to negotiate that in the final moments of a conference committee in the consultation with the governor and the leadership of the House and Senate. Otherwise, there would have been zero. And we would have waited two more years. So, and that was, I'll be very honest, I made changes to the Clean Water Council recommendations because I felt, along in with the testimony, we had public testimony from people on plastics, that it was an emerging issue that was needed right now, that we needed to do work right now. And so I applaud the agencies for following up with the 400,000. We needed more money. We will need more money on this. And on your issue of what can we do, one of the examples would be there are things that we can control in state government without being, you know, as in the universities here, the washing machines, should they have filters put on them, in our prisons, in our public entities, what can we do with filters, with our water treatment? What can we do as not only as individuals, but as institutions and as the public institutions, whether they're state, university, whether they're city, whether they're county, there are things that we could maybe do to try to reduce the impact of those microplastics right now, because it appears that the more that we look, the more we find. And we weren't looking, so we weren't finding, and now we are. And I think that the public is rightly concerned. I have yet to find one person that wants to drink plastic. Unless there's somebody here, I don't know if there's anybody who likes drinking plastic particles. So. I think we're off to a good start. The hearing this week of getting that lays a foundation, but we are going to need to have more involvement and more ideas on this, because I think it's a very large issue. Any other on the microplastics?
Yep.
You're not the person who wants to drink plastic, right?
Give me those bottles.
My name is Jane Peck. I'm from Lanesboro. I happen to live actually right on the north branch of the Root River. And so I'm very in tune with how this rain just washes everything right down into the Mississippi. It's like a giant pipe. So I guess my question for you is, are you monitoring, or do you have a way to monitor water that seeps through landfills? Because we know these landfills are full of plastic, and that, at least in southeast Minnesota, is going either straight down the rivers or straight through the karst into the groundwater. So landfills.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, definitely that will be something that will be looked at. The Pollution Control Agency monitors that landfill effluent for a number of things. I don't believe they're looking at plastics right now, but that's the purpose of some of this funding, for us to look at those materials and try to figure out where these things are coming from. I agree they're a likely source of microplastics to the environment, landfills, et cetera. So yes, we'll be looking into that.
Thank you. Mr. Smith. And Mr. Smith has a PowerPoint. He's representing the Minnesota Department of Transportation and talking about conservation materials. So some of the plastics that we actually use for conservation and maybe some ideas there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Smith. I'm a wildlife ecologist with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Also here with me today is Peter Leet in the back. He is a transportation hydrologist with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. He also serves as the MnDOT DNR liaison. I'm here today to provide a brief overview of plastics and erosion prevention and sediment control practices and the progress that MnDOT has made to address the environmental concerns surrounding plastic use. So first, I want to start off with a couple definitions. While sometimes used interchangeably by manufacturers and erosion control practitioners, the terms degradable and biodegradable are distinctly different. Many plastic products used in erosion control are degradable, not biodegradable. These degradable products send microplastics into the environment. Here you can see several additional concerns surrounding the use of plastics as erosion control products. One of the best studied conservation concerns is actually the entanglement of wildlife via erosion control netting or blanket. I'll come back to this on the next slide. Of increasing interest, and the reason that many of us are here today, are the potential impacts associated with microplastics. In an effort to better understand this issue, both MnDOT and DNR staff have been reviewing the research on the topic and working collaboratively within our agencies to reduce the amount of plastic used along state roadways. In fact, DNR frequently now includes a requirement in their public waters work permit that we must use non-plastic erosion control materials. Here you can see some of the erosion control blanket that was installed along a bridge. The water level rose and it entangled fish. We have many documented cases of a whole variety of wildlife where this has happened. And then these products degrade into smaller plastic particles, which I think many here are familiar with. It's important to keep in mind that many of these erosion control products and practices are meant to be temporary. You should have all received a copy of a handout that Peter created. For those of you in the audience, it's on the back table. It includes some back of the napkin estimates for the amount of plastic being placed in the environment for each product. While these numbers are rough estimates, and I stress that, they help illustrate the level of plastic use and the potential opportunities that MnDOT has to take the lead on reducing plastic use. In fact, I'm pleased to say that MnDOT very recently phased out the use of temporary plastic erosion control blanket on all of its projects. Here you can see this temporary erosion control blanket, the plastic version. It often outlives its intended purpose by many, many years. It often balls up, it can entangle wildlife, it degrades slowly over time in getting into our water resources. Here you can see a natural fiber alternative. This is becoming the norm now. One of the first questions that we're often asked when we discuss this topic is whether or not there are alternatives. In many cases, there are alternatives already readily available. And through collaboration with industry, we hope that additional alternatives to plastic products can be developed. Here's just a couple more examples for you. Frequently used plastic-based, or at least products with plastic components on the left, and then natural fiber alternatives on the right. Silt fence, this is often used as perimeter control on construction projects. You've all probably seen this. It's supposed to be removed. It's not always removed, so then that plastic material stays in the environment. An alternative that we're using increasingly is actually using wood chips and creating a berm along the perimeter of a project. Many of these projects include some tree clearing anyways, and so we can actually chip up those trees on site, use that on the construction site. This also reduces the risk of invasive species spread by moving wood around. Hydromulch is another product. This is the green stuff you see sprayed along construction projects. Actually, only fairly recently did we discover that some of the products, and again, this is just some of them, actually have fibers added to them to increase their strength. And sometimes those fibers are actually plastic. This is actually an example of, this is virgin polypropylene. So this isn't even recycled plastic that's being added to hydromulch and sprayed into the environment. And again, that sheet that Peter created has some calculations on what the equivalent number of pop bottles and things of that nature would be. And it's an alarming amount of plastic being sprayed into the environment. There are wood fiber alternatives. And then newer things that are coming online, this is actually hemp fiber. And so we could potentially use hemp and other natural fibers for that purpose as well. And last but certainly not least, sediment logs. Again, another very common practice on construction projects. Often have a plastic netting or a plastic sleeve over them. Again, this is often left in the environment. It degrades and contributes to the microplastic problem. But again, there are many natural fiber alternatives, as you can see here. And that is all I have. I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, I would assume that these silt fences should be part of the contract. So if they aren't always removed, why isn't the contractor held responsible to remove them when a project's done?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you are correct. It is typically a requirement on the contract. Often the removal of the silt fence is one of the very last items after a construction project's being completed. The amount of dollars that are held before closing out that contract are often relatively small. And so some contractors choose to not return to the site, remobilize and remove the products. Also, we do currently allow under our specifications that the silt fence, the way it's installed, typically by a machine that's in the ground, typically when they are removing it, they're just cutting it at the base of the silt fence. So there's still several inches of silt fence left in the ground. Again, that's going to remain in the environment. And so there's still plastic remaining on site. And so again, we're reviewing our practices, trying to identify opportunities to address these concerns.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that answer. I'm hoping that we can tighten up those contracts because it's obviously a issue for our environment. So in 2014, I was county board chair and we had a flood and we had to order sandbags. So the new sandbags that we had compared to the sandbags that were from the last flood that we had, and everybody knows what floods are like, we've all experienced them, degrade very quickly. Has MnDOT looked at using that type of material for silt fences? Because when we had to go through the process of picking up those sandbags, you actually had to use a skid steer or something like that because they had degraded quickly enough in 3 or 4 months. And I'm thinking for the average road projects, when you have to have silt fences up, if that type of material would be a usable alternative.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's something I'd have to get back to you on. Although I will mention that if the new sandbag material is still a petroleum-based plastic product, it may degrade quicker, but it's often still degrading into smaller plastic particles and remaining into the environment. And so while it might be out of sight, out of mind, it's still contributing to the problem. But certainly I can look into that and follow up with you if you'd like.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other members? Any members of the audience have any questions for Mr. Smith?
Back in time for questions. Sure.
That's okay.
Cheryl Jefferson again, a professor emeritus, plant ecology here from Winona State, and longtime environmental activist. My question for you is, I've spent some time in the Southeast, former teaching place and consulting and various things, and just recently this last year, looking at what they're doing on stream sides, intertidal areas, and silt control, especially near waterways. Their answer down there is something I wonder whether we could use some combination of here. Down there, they're using compostable fiber, meaning wood fiber or hay or whatever, mixed with mussel shells or clam shells or whatever. Now, you up in the Arrowhead country, you know in Lake Superior, we're now got zebra mussels everywhere in the state. We have plenty of tons and tons and tons of zebra mussel shells piling up down here. Can we find something that might be our Midwestern equivalent of what they're doing in the Southeast, where we could be possible? We have more buckthorn than we possibly know what to do with. Buckthorn's rather fibrous. Grind it up. Use that for your fiber. Can it be spun? I have no idea. Can it be woven? I have no idea. And combined for the ballasting part, our invasive mussels, because we have more coming and more that are here. And it's endangering our lakes as well as the Great Lakes, so, and the upper Mississippi. Shoot, maybe jumping carp can be used for all I know. But anyway, I think there's some type of new innovations we could be thinking about using our invasive species here. Even some of our big invasive grasses, they make great fibers. They're hard to get rid of. We canary grass. Figure out how we can use it and replace the plastics with things we don't want here anyway, and will not wreck the environment since they're dead and will degrade. So that's my off the wall suggestion for tonight.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. We definitely are trying to incorporate more natural fibers into our erosion control practices, including Minnesota grown fibers. I don't know, Peter, if you have any knowledge about us trying to use mussel shells or other innovative things like that. As a reminder, Peter Leet is the transportation hydrologist with the Department of Natural Resources.
Hi, I'm Peter Leet with DNR, as mentioned. I am not aware of any specific studies, but we certainly have been talking about trying to utilize products that are here from Minnesota, but agriculture industry, the recycling industry. We've certainly talked about it, but if we find some information, I'll certainly pass that on.
On that point, where do you source your hemp from? Is it Minnesota? Or?
So, Mr. Chair, at this point, we haven't used hemp, but it's something that we're looking at, and we would like to work with industry to develop those products. It's something we're just starting to look into.
Any other questions for Mr. Smith? A couple of them here.
Mr. Chairman, Glenn Groth, local resident. We talk about a Midwestern solution. One thing we do have in abundance here is corn, soybeans. What about bioplastics, something that can degrade the environment, that can be made with something we have in abundance of here for use in a various control projects, erosion control projects by various state agencies?
Mr. Smith.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, another very good question. It's something that we've started to look into. I will admit that it's not my area of expertise as far as the chemistry involved in the developing of some of these plastics. I will tell you that some of the standards, the ASTM standards for testing compostability and biodegradability and things of that nature, there is now a test for bioplastics. Unfortunately, it only covers things in commercial compost settings. And so in the real world environment, we're still not sure if those bioplastics actually biodegrade versus becoming, again, microplastics, just with a slightly different chemical composition.
Sorry, it's been 30 years.
No, you've been in the southeastern
yep.
Minnesota.
Yep.
So I'm going to take advantage of that today. Mike Kennedy again. Mr. Smith, organic fiber would be less costly labor-wise. And as Mr. Representative Eklund pointed out, it's the removal or non-removal of a lot of it because it's embedded in the soil when you're using erosion control. Organic would be less costly to use because you don't have to remove it. Decays, and it decays in an organic matter. I would think that, I think it's only been the last year or two that Minnesota has legalized the growing of commercial hemp. Hemp comes in, it's kind of like water. There's potable and non-potable hemp. So the commercial hemp has been legalized in Minnesota. I would think it would be a panacea for row crop farmers that have looked at it and not had a market for it. This could be a national market, not just a Minnesota market for hemp growers in Minnesota. And maybe we could plant a little less corn and have a little lower subsidies. But I would pursue that aggressively, organic use of hemp mats and fibers in other erosion control processes. It's very strong. It has a great reputation other than its illegal side.
Mr. Smith.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, again, thank you for the question. And as I mentioned, we are very interested in the possibility of using especially Minnesota grown hemp. We do, MnDOT has a really good relationship with the industry that manufactures these different products. And we are interested in discussions with the industry to see if we can't develop that market.
And Mr. Smith, you're going to be around after your speech?
Yes, I will, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Next, we'll move on to, thank you. We'll move on to Dr. Elaine Evans from the University of Minnesota, and she's going to talk a little bit about pollinators. As Dr. Evans is getting ready, in the hallway, we have a couple of displays on chronic wasting disease from the University of Minnesota. I know that they brought a number of materials, but I think they may have, all those materials may have disappeared throughout the day. So, but that, there are those displays that are available and you is able to come out and talk about those as well. We will be having a joint House and Senate hearing on chronic wasting disease on October 29th at the state capitol. Dr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Elaine Evans. I'm from the University of Minnesota, where I'm an extension educator focused on pollinators. Apologies that I just put these slides together, so I didn't get them to you ahead of time. But I am here today to talk about generally about the status of pollinators in Minnesota. And I'm going to talk a lot about bumblebees, but before I do that, I want to just talk more broadly about pollinators. So pollinators are a very broad group that are really important for both our food systems and for our environmental health. There's lots of different insects in Minnesota that will visit flowers and will pollinate, but bees are the primary group that are really doing a lot of this pollination. And we have a diverse range of pollinators here in Minnesota. So far, we know about around 470 different species of bees that we have in Minnesota. We're still finding new species every time we go out and you know, collect in different parts of the state. So that's a growing list. In terms of understanding about the status of the bees, it's a lot harder to track because there are so many of these different bees and their populations do go up and down. Many people are familiar with honeybees, which are very important in our agriculture systems. They're the only bee in Minnesota that's producing honey, but those are a managed bee, so they're not native, so it's more like livestock. In terms of their status, we're not worried about their population. They're not going to go extinct. They do have health problems, and it's important for them to get support from having flowers that they can get nutrients from and so that they can maintain healthy populations. But in terms of our native pollinators that we have here in Minnesota, the ones that we know the most about are our bumblebees. So I'm going to focus on what we know about them and how they're doing. Generally, across North America, we know that there are a good number of bumblebee species that are in trouble. So roughly one out of every three species of bumblebees are threatened or near threatened, according to the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And that same pattern holds in Minnesota. We have, again, the number is a little loose, but it's around 23 species of bumblebees that we have historical records for here in Minnesota. We're still figuring out how many of those we still have. But we have, four or five species where we're really concerned about how their populations are doing. One that has gotten the most attention here in Minnesota is the rusty patch bumblebee. This is the only bee currently within the continental U.S. to have federal protection as an endangered species with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Minnesota is a special place for the rusty patch bumblebee. Before the year 2000, they were found throughout good chunks of eastern North America down through the Appalachians. But since then, they're only found in about 5% of the places where they used to be found, and only about 5% of their former abundance. And Minnesota is one of those, one of those few places where they're still left. For bumblebees generally, when we're looking at what's causing their problems, and this actually applies to what we know about a lot of the other pollinators that are having problems, there can be problems with pathogens. And those pathogens can come from different places. For bumblebees, there's concern about spread from commercial bumblebees. There are commercially produced bumblebees produced in just a couple of places in North America that are then shipped throughout North America for use primarily in greenhouses, but also for some field pollination. And when these colonies have diseases, they go out to shared flowers with wild bumblebees, and these pathogens can spread. There's also concern about that happening from honeybees that have some shared diseases. Pesticides are a big concern for pollinators. We know that that not just insecticides, but we're learning more about the impact of fungicides being something that we're seeing a lot of negative impacts on pollinators. And these things can interact. So we're seeing interactions with the fungicides reducing the ability of the bees to fight off pathogens. Climate change is another big concern, especially for bumblebees. We know the most about them for this impact. Bumblebees are more adapted to northern climates than other bees are. And when we look at models of future climates, we see a lot of shrinking of the ranges of where these bumblebees will be able to survive. Habitat loss is something that compounds with these other things too. We know they need places to live, they need flowers, which is where they get all of their food. And that habitat loss is compounded by changes that are happening with climate change. In addition to pathogens, there's also parasites that we're concerned about, and there's possibilities of competition with honeybees. So honeybees are a beneficial insect overall, but they are really good at getting to the flowers that are the most productive and really taking those resources. And so when there aren't enough resources around, honeybees tend to be the best at getting those resources, and that can have a negative effect on other bees that are needing those resources to survive. In Minnesota here, we've been doing a lot to protect our bees generally, and also to learn about them. So we have a few different programs that have been going on here where the public can be involved. So people want to know how they can help pollinators. There's things like planting flowers, keeping areas that are protected, you know, not having pesticides on flowers that these bees will be using. But we can also get help from people in terms of figuring out what bees are where, especially when we're dealing with an endangered species. When we're developing recovery plans for those bees, it really helps to know where they are. And so we have a few different programs. One of them has just been kind of focused in the Twin Cities area. The Minnesota Bee Atlas is something that a program that's funded by the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and that's been looking throughout the state. Bumblebee Watch is a broader program that anyone can participate in. The Bee Atlas, you do need some training to be able to do that, but we do have a great set of volunteers that are doing that. Bumblebee Watch is one that anybody with a phone or with a camera and a computer can take pictures of bees and share them with us. For the Rusty Patch Bumblebee here in Minnesota, we've been at the Minnesota, I'm really proud of the actions that we've taken. We've made it our state bee. There's been a lot of awareness that has been growing, but things have been up and down. Last year was a really hopeful year. We saw more rusty patch bumblebees than we had previously. We saw them more places. We're still getting data coming in from this year, but so far, unfortunately, we've been seeing a lot fewer rusty patch bumblebees. We've been seeing them in a lot fewer places. And we know that these populations go up and down, but it is still a concern that Minnesota is one of the only remaining places where we're reliably finding these populations, and we're still seeing these dips down when numbers are already so low.
I think Vice Chair Claflin found one of that. What did you do to confirm?
That's correct. I did find a rusty patch bumblebee in my yard and confirmed it through Bumblebee Watch. And I also found a sunflower bee with beautiful green eyes. So lots of good bees in my yard if you want to come look.
I think we're going to compress, Dr. Evans, we're going to wait and hold questions after the other two speakers just to make sure we have enough time at the end. So I have Caitlin O'Connor with Prairie Moon Nursery. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hi, welcome. Mr. Chairman and representatives. Thanks so much for the opportunity to be here and speak with you tonight. My name is Caitlin O'Connor. I am a local Winona resident and employee of Prairie Moon Nursery, a local business in rural Winona, and I'm their education and outreach specialist. So pollinators have been getting a lot of buzz lately, excuse my pun, but it's with good reason. These insects are responsible for pollinating 80% of the world's plants, and that includes a lot of our food crops that are really important to human society. As the renowned scientist E.O. Wilson once said, insects are the little things that run the world, and it really is true. But these little critters are in trouble. We've heard a little bit about their population struggles from a previous speaker. It's estimated that insects worldwide have decreased about 45% in the last 40 years. Our monarch populations in North America have plummeted about 80% in the last 20 years, and the rusty patch bumblebee almost 95% in that same time frame. It's a concern. It's a real concern. And one of the main contributors to that population decline is habitat loss, as we saw in the earlier presentation. So I want to briefly touch on this focus that sometimes the conversation around pollinators tends to center on honeybees. But honeybees really are domesticated livestock. They're not at risk of extinction. And so trying to fix our pollinator population declines by focusing on the honeybee is a lot like trying to fix our problems with wildlife populations by focusing on chickens. So the good news is that a lot of the things that we can do to help our native pollinators are automatically by default going to help the honeybees as well. And that's because honeybees are generalists. That means that they can get food sources from lots of different plants out there. But a lot of our native pollinators are specialists, which means that they require a native North American plant in order to complete their life cycle. So the most iconic example of this is the monarch butterflies. You know, they require milkweed to sustain their populations. And in fact, 90% of our plant-eating insects are specialist insects. And so we really need this diversity of native plants out on the landscape to support the populations of pollinators that we're concerned about. So it's been so wonderful to learn about the work that's been going done with the new grant program with Lawns to Legumes. There's a great focus on native plants in that program, and it's really innovative because I think it's the first program of its kind in the country even that incentivizes urban landowners to be a part of habitat restoration, when so often habitat restoration conversations are only focused on public lands and maybe farmers who hold large portions of land. But I think it's something like 85% of all of the land east of the Rockies is held by privately owned individuals. It is not enough to just focus habitat restoration efforts on public land. We need to engage private landowners in all ways, shapes, and forms if we're really going to make significant advances on this issue. And the citizens of Winona have a really strong land ethic. And I believe that Minnesotans in general have a really strong land ethic. We value the resources that we have here in our state. And Winonas have done a lot of great work on this issue, from environmental education to habitat restoration. So I just want to shout out some of the great work that's been going on in the community, just to kind of raise awareness about what's happening on the grassroots level here. So Winona State University has multiple native plant gardens, and they've dedicated their university arboretum to showcasing the native plants of this region. The nonprofit organization Sustainable Driftless has created an award-winning documentary that's being shown at film festivals around the globe at this point about the uniqueness and the ecological value of the Driftless region here in southeastern Minnesota. The local chapter of the Prairie Enthusiasts have been doing great restoration work on the endangered habitat of the goat prairies, which we heard mentioned earlier this evening. And Garvin Heights, this partnership between the city of Winona and Winona State is amidst a multi-year restoration project. Clean Lake Winona is another nonprofit organization that is focusing on habitat restoration along the bike trails and the shorelines on Lake Winona. There's really a lot of interest and traction here, and the citizens here really want more. We want to do more. And so I think any kind of ways that we can promote habitat restoration and really empower citizens to do that right in their own backyard is going to go a really long way into addressing this issue in a meaningful way. And as politicians in the state of Minnesota, you all hold a great power to influence land management in our state. Not only is habitat restoration a solution to our pollinator issues, but habitat restoration is a solution to a whole suite of environmental problems, including water quality and soil health and climate change. And so it's kind of a catch-all for a lot of different things. So whether it's suburban yards or farm fields or corporate offices and rooftops in the city or trout streams, by simply promoting native plants, we can all work together to bring the ecological integrity back to the land that's right here beneath our feet. Thank you.
Thank you. And Annalie Garlitz. With the Minnesota DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz. I'm with the Minnesota DNR.
and been asked to come here this evening to provide an update on what's been going on with the Minnesota Bee Survey. To reiterate what Dr. Evans said in the previous presentation, we know that bees are integral parts of the Minnesota ecosystem. And while we do know many pieces about the diversity and distribution of bees in our state, large gaps do exist, which is why ongoing research is important and continues to be important. I'm going to direct you to this nice colorful brochure that was in the back. There's plenty of copies back there if you do want to see it. In 2019, DNR received an additional LCC MARV appropriation to continue work on our native bee survey. This is going to be the third round of work that we've done on it. Project goals for this survey are to create a list of Minnesota bees in the state, to survey bees across the state, and to conduct pollinator education and research throughout the state to help us understand what's going on and to help us with identification efforts. You can see through the map on here, on the presentation, our Minnesota Biological Survey staff have collected data from insect collections with Minnesota collected specimens to establish the state list of bees at approximately 450 species. We've completed baseline surveys in 71 counties in the Prairie Parkland, Tallgrass Aspen Parkland, and Eastern Broadleaf Forest ecological provinces. And we've collected over 41,000 specimens, which have to be processed, identified, and confirmed by a taxonomist. We've identified 242 species through our DNR surveys, and we've added four species that were previously not in our list to the list of DNR collected specimens. Staff have also co-organized three bee identification workshops for conservation professionals to use out in the fields to help them with identification. And we've also improved understanding of bee distributional records in Minnesota, including rare species such as the yellow-banded bumblebee and the rusty-patched bumblebee, our state bee. Future plans moving forward, now that we have received another round of dollars for this program, we will be doing three more bee identification workshops that will be planned for the Laurentian mixed forest area, and those will be for conservation professionals to use. There will be more bee surveys in this area of the state and in the blue shaded area. And then there will be a full report on the Minnesota bee survey to date. And we expect that in 2022, once the survey is done and that taxonomist has taken a look at everything that's been brought back to them and identified it.
Great.
That is my brief update.
Any questions? Nathan?
I think you kind of touched on it there. Northeast, probably third, maybe almost half of the state. There's been a pretty limited amount of surveys. You just need to explain that a little bit.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, we will be expanding over there. The program started, first received money in 2014. So we've been slowly working, and it takes a lot of time to go out there and find them and bring them back. So that will be the goal, is to continue working up. We have been in 71 counties to provide that baseline level of information. If you want some more information about the counties we have started in, I can get that to you.
Any members of the public who have questions for any of the three speakers or any other topic? Go ahead.
First, I want to ask Gabe Erickson if he wants to address this. Gabe here is a person of prairie restoration. He's been a commercial honeybee raiser. Gabe, you want to take my place in first?
I have something to say.
I'll come after him. He's a good guy.
What all they said was really great. Just Gabe Erickson, I'm a contractor here, landscape contractor with a focus on native plants. I also do prairie restoration kind of fall and winter. So I'm working up on the goat prairies, climbing these 45 degree slopes in the snow with a chainsaw. But one of my latest things, I've been kind of talking to MnDOT about this, talking to the county about this. one of our biggest areas that we have of space that's like a ready-made space for us to use for pollinators is our roadsides. And it's a ton of acreage. It's land that's not really being used for anything else right now. And it's connecting everything. So it's like natural corridors connecting all these different ecosystems already. I know Dayton had started working on this, and it just seems like it's coming along really slowly. And I know Iowa has a really good program already developed called IRVM. They're working with the Tallgrass Prairie Center, and most counties have already implemented IRVM plans where they are managing their invasive species with timed mowings and timed herbicide treatments, rather than what a lot of our counties are doing right now is waiting until the invasive species seeds are ripe and then mowing through them and dragging those seeds up the valleys, up down the roadsides, just spreading the invasive species. So if we had a more integrative approach to dealing with invasive species, and then if we could figure out a way to fund more native seed plantings on our roadsides, we'd be making a huge difference really quickly. And I know we don't have the Living Roadway Trust Fund like Iowa has, but I think we could develop something kind of similar to that. And I have to believe that Minnesota could even come up with a better system than Iowa's even using. But yeah, thank you. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Good job, Gabe. Gabe has pointed out indirectly, without telling you what you need to know, one reason we're mowing our county ditches at the wrong time is we can't mow the county ditches because until after July 31st. Winona County does about July 15th. That's for the nesting birds on the county ditches. But when they do that, that's exactly when wild parsnip, garlic mustard, Japanese, everything, not weed, whatever, that's when their seeds are ready. So there's got to be some trade-off here. And maybe when we have really important corridors that connect habitats, like in our valleys down here in the Driftless area, we need to think what we're doing on those roadside ditches. I have a constant battle with the county because I have a long stretch of a county state aid road on my property, as does Gabe, my neighbor, good guy. This is completely wrong what they're doing ecologically. And so it gets to be a battle. Can I get out there with my tractor first to beat them so I can mow down the invasive species? Can you, Gabe, get ahead of them? Now, but next I want to talk about, I live in Wilson Township, which is rural Winona County, and my family has a farm in Warren Township, and this farm we bought with the intention of renewable energy. We have a small wind generator, lots of solar panels, but one thing we're trying to do is the farm that we have is it's organic. We're restoring our native habitat as best we can. But when I get out on these township roads in Winona County, and on days that they're spraying Roundup Ready crops, I'm instantly aware as an ecologist what they're doing. They're destroying the vegetation, the native flora. For example, on the 4th of July weekend, this is just an anecdote, but the 4th of July weekend, we had a family gathering out at the farm. And we're on the last year of a contract with this particular farmer to mow our last piece, okay, before we put it over to prairie. And he sprays Roundup in a big wind. It's everywhere. It destroyed, despite the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pollinator plants we put in there, milkweed, etc. It's all dead now after spraying on the 4th of July, all of our work. This is a problem. We're losing the biodiversity in our township, along our township right-of-ways. And of course, in the 1970s, with the consolidation of farms, we lost our fence rows. We lost a lot of conservation structures from the 1930s, and many of these conservation structures were the exact places where the pollinators could concentrate. So we need a more coherent policy as to what we're doing in the rural areas if we want to have the insect diversity. It is nothing here in Winona County today compared to when I came here about 45 years ago. There's no crickets. I used to be awake all night listening to the crickets. There's one or two tree frogs in the whole valley this year. The cricket frogs are gone. The beaver are gone. It's silent. We are in a silent spring crisis right now, relative to especially the insectivorous birds and the insects. It is unbelievable. We
do not have what you grew up, and you're a lot younger than I am.
It's unbelievable the last couple of years. This is the state. I have property up on Lake Superior, the same thing. We don't have the birds. We don't have the insects. This, in my estimation, is largely because of massive use of herbicides and insecticides, pesticides of one type or another, as well as habitat loss, habitat fragmentation. But there's things that we can do. We have to watch out for conflicting policies. And now I'd like to jump to my last thing about chronic wasting disease, if I may. I'm concerned down here as a rural landowner with the new rule because of chronic wasting disease here, that there'd be unlimited kill of antlerless deer. I'm very much afraid of that because I believe we're going to get overrun by just wanton deer killers. I think it's not going to be all for harvest. I think it's going to be, it's dangerous. My property is dangerous. Our farm area is dangerous. People hunt where they want. They don't stay 200 feet for 500 feet from your house. They shoot right across your property, your backyard, and target your bird feeders while they're at it. I know this sounds a bit bitter, but I'm really worried about this unrestricted antlerless hunt this fall and how many people are just going to be gunning out of here for target practice and what that means for the safety of our children. We have to spend our entire fall with my children and grandchildren and myself with safety vest on in the rural areas. This is a real danger, this policy of murder all the deer this fall. It's got to be a big public education thing right now about what you're doing with these murdering the deer. I otherwise believe it will just be wild and wanton slaughter, and there are going to be people, innocent children particularly, injured. So there's my political spiel, and thank you for your time. And as Mike says, it's great having you back here after 30 years. We've aged, but we still are outspoken. Thank you.
Thank you. I did have one person who wanted to testify who has been waiting patiently, so I want to make sure we get her in.
I'm a farmer down in Houston County, and I've been in CRP probably for 30-some years.
You could state your name.
Joan Heim Welch, and I've been in CRP for over 30 years, and I see the benefit of nature, and I've just started putting some land in the long or tall grass prairie, and all the bees out there, and all the nature and all, it's just beautiful. You know, I just love it. And it would be nice with just about every one of my neighbors rent out their property. And if there was an incentive, so instead of renting it out to a farmer to put it into a CRP program, that would be beneficial to everything, you know, the water, clean water. I'm also on the water board down in Houston County, and I was picked for Houston County Conservationist of the Year because I do so much. I probably have 160 some acres in CRP, and it's in a lot of different programs. And I have, I was in a CSP program, and I planted a pollinator with just beautiful flowers. Lupines and it's out of that program, but I can't mow it down. I just leave it. I just love it. But it would be nice to see more people get into the CRP for the bees and for the butterflies. This year I've seen millions of monarchs too. Finally, you know, they're back. Yeah, and I just love it.
Could you maybe mention what CRP is?
Conservation Reserve Program. And there's all different kinds of CRP, like the tall grass prairie. And like for me, I have cattle too. I have beef cattle. And through Conservation Reserve, every 3 years, you can like graze or hay a little bit of it. And if there's a disaster, then you can hay some, you know, if you need the hay. And last year I hayed some because last year the hay was really, really high and I know I was running short. So I did cut some, which rejuvenates it again, makes it nice. And in my reserve, I take care of my conservation reserve land. I get permission to go in there and
spray a little bit if some invasive, like multi-floral rose. I don't know if anybody knows about that, but it's a really bad, like a berry bush that really has like an eagle claw on it that really wrecks and takes over the woods. And of course, buckthorn and barberry. And I do a lot in my woods too. I do private forest management too. But it would be nice for more people to get into it and for the state of Minnesota to maybe give farmers so they won't go out and rent their land to somebody who will just plow up everything and spray into everything to protect nature.
One bill we had last year was to do with CRP, which is a federal program, and the rental rates are now under the county, I think 20% under the county average rental rate. Is if a landowner, a farmer went in, they could sign up with NRCS, the federal agency, and then maybe go to the Soil and Water District in the same office and get a payment of $100 or $150 per acre signing bonus to help, depending on the mix of the seed, that the cost of the seed maybe has some type of incentive. So that's something I think we'll be looking at again. Is that what you're talking about? That type of
thing? Yeah. Yeah, very, very good program. And I think I got in on that. I got an incentive on my tall grass prairie. And I love it. I'd put more into it. Yeah, it's work, but it's well worth it.
Any questions from members? We have about 7 minutes left. I think we're going to, so I see there's a couple other people who want to testify. So I want to make sure we've given everybody who hasn't testified yet the opportunity to comment or ask questions. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jeff Broberg, a local resident, live in Elba Township, Winona County, and involved in a lot of different things. I'm a director of the Minnesota Well Owners Organization, the National Trout Center in Preston, and Fresh Energy. I'm going to talk about four, just really briefly, critical issues for southeastern Minnesota. The first is about the legacy funding, the second about the fish kill in Garvin, climate resiliency and drinking water safety. The legacy funds are so important for our part of the state. I don't know if you've seen the maps or the data. We have less than 3% public land in this part of the state. Hardly any of the land that you drove by on your trip today is public land. You went to some of the gems, and we have a lot of other opportunities. And the work that the legacy has done in the past few years, acquisition of the Girl Scouts camps, 800 acres, the Choice WMA, almost 2,000 acres, two full trout stream watersheds for Maple Creek and Etna Creek. Just amazing legacy from Minnesota, and we really appreciate that. I can't tell you how grateful I am to see that work done here and how important it is for everybody in Minnesota. It's a really interesting, amazing place, and to preserve those areas with the foresight we've had is really important. I want to talk about the fish kill, and I want to talk about prevention. The thing that we're missing in all of these incidents is a move to try and prevent these things from happening again. We're finding a theme. The trout kills are happening when we have rain on saturated ground. And it appears that the things that we're doing on the land when it's saturated are the problem. We don't have an exact cause, but we have to be able to teach people how to prevent this. We take an enforcement approach to try to blame somebody. I think that's the wrong approach. I don't think we're going to regulate our way out of safety for our water. I have farmers coming to me asking, how do I know what not to do? That is the most important thing. So we need to focus our efforts on finding out what the probable cause is and advising people this is how we prevent it from happening again. The next thing is climate resiliency. We are having climate change. I've lived it in my own life here, and we're seeing it most dramatically with the amount of rainfall and the intensity that occurs. Last year, Caledonia had a record rainfall of almost 63 inches in a year. That's Louisiana rainfall. Rochester just passed a record for its average annual rainfall. We don't know how to deal with our landscape when we have these big events so frequently and for so long. These are things that are critical for our infrastructure, they're critical for our way of life, and we need to be prepared. We cannot remain in denial about what we need to do about climate and resiliency. We're failing this right now. And the last thing, real briefly, is safe drinking water. You saw the karst and you had the opportunity to see both parts of it. You saw the worm's eye view in a cave. And then today you were standing on a trout stream where that water is seeping out of the ground under your feet. It's a short circuit from the surface through the ground and back to the surface again. And it gives us all these wonderful resources, the trout streams, the cold water, and all of these things. But it's extremely susceptible to contamination. And I believe we're taking the wrong approach. We need to focus on people's water quality at their kitchen sink. We need people to first have safe water. Oftentimes, the test will show you that you need treatment to drink your water. I can't drink my water. It's contaminated above the health risk limit. But I know what to do. What we need to do, we are not going to solve the problem of the contamination fast enough to protect families. We need water testing universally. We need people to have access to convenient, low-cost testing. And we need programs that will help them provide safe drinking water at home, whether that's through advice, incentives, whatever it is. We can't go on thinking that we're going to solve a landscape problem when people cannot drink their water at home. Thank you.
Any questions? Anybody else? Yep.
I'll make this quick. It's going to be a little redundant because Mr. Broberg made some very valid points. Because you had some field trips where it seemed like the theme was water. And I'm glad that you had the time to see the bottom and the top. Because we are unique in this karst topography landscape and valley that we call home here in southeastern Minnesota. And I know that you all represent areas north of South St. Paul. So again, I'm taking advantage of this 30-year opportunity to speak to you about southeastern Minnesota, and it is different. I'm going to classify it as you got wet behind your ears today, which is an old saying about important first lessons. If you know anybody on the Cal Fremling? Did you go on the cruise? All right. Did you learn anything about the Hexagena bilineata mayfly that Cal Fremling spent his lifetime studying? That was an indicator of water pollution, and it has been very helpful. He also wrote Immortal River, basically the Bible on the Mississippi River. And that's his boat, and thanks to Winona State for putting that together. I have a few more P-word concerns. Seems like today was plastics and pollinators. I got a few more P-words for you to add to your list today, not to discuss, but to inform legislators and state officials of ongoing problems that need attention. Potable water, meaning not polluted with nitrates, animal manure, and pesticides. Our unique porous geology mandates different protections for health and safety issues that don't exist upstate. 70% of private wells have existing nitrate levels that are above safe limits. Another P word, precipitation. Amounts that have historically never been experienced, as he said. Double maximum annual rainfall amounts in southeastern Minnesota, causing record flooding for agriculture and riverine municipalities, resulting in severe long-term economic problems for all. Climate change is real and needs to be part of every business plan, public and private. One last B word, and I just want you to carry this back with you, because us here in southern Minnesota have concerns that are statewide also. And my last P word is Polymet Mining Corporation, or what has long, all along really been Glencore, who is a criminally guilty polluter around the world. Don't let them into the sacred ground in northern Minnesota. I hope it's not too late. They are an invasive species that damages everything they touch. I love the boundary waters, and I love to go from here up to there. And I think we need to pay a little more attention to the mining interests and what happened at the MPCA as far as some shenanigans going on with the studies that weren't really submitted when they should have been. So that's it. Thank you for coming. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. I know the staff are looking at their watch up there. I'm wondering if we're close. Is there anyone else who would like to provide any comment or questions?
I'm going to add one more thing. I'm talking to Mr. Kroger. My daughter was chosen as the leading climate change scientist in the country last year by the American Association of Advancement of Science. And she is now working for the state of Ohio at Kent State University and previously at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and then at Oregon State University, each case as a hydrologist. And in each case, this is something Minnesota ought to do. Take a look what North Carolina has done and Ohio. The funding for her position as a professor, which is teaching two courses a year, the rest research and public outreach, involvement government agencies, et cetera, is legislative funding. Winona State is right here in the Driftless area. There should be special funding for people in these different institutions. Forget the politics of Rochester. We are in the Driftless area. They aren't. How about some special allocation for faculty members that can really address the regional biological water quality issues? Take a look at what North Carolina was done, Oregon, Ohio, lots of other states. Don't press us off because we're down here in the corner of the state. This is the most biologically diverse and the most geologically and hydrologically vulnerable. We are the most vulnerable in so many directions from an ecologist point of view, but there is no money here. As a plant ecologist, my position was when I retired at the end of 2006, officially the first time, I never got replaced. Kel Fremling never got replaced. None of the ecologists are getting replaced, quite frankly. And when our next one goes in a couple of years, he's 62, he probably won't get replaced. So there's a lot of state money going into biomedical stuff down here, but we are in the Driftless area. We are in the Karst topography, the most biologically diverse, the most geologically sensitive area. Let's get a pocket of dedicated funds. Take a look at other states. So my daughter has, again, worked for Kent State University, but most of her money for her position is coming from a state, from the state legislature. North Carolina probably has the best model. I think it's time we do that. Let's not ignore places outside the metropolitan area. Let's look at where the state is divided from a natural point of view, not a demographic point of view. And let's put some money where we need to put it. Try that for a unique idea. And I guess that's my last harangue. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? We have all of these speakers are still here. So if we do, when we do adjourn here, if people have questions and they're feeling shy, we will be around for a little bit and the speakers will as well. So thank you very much. And with that, we are adjourned.